J.S. Bach, Little Fugue in G minor, and version by Leopold Stokowski. And we'll go out with a little more Stokowski Bach. And thanks for being with me, and especially thanks for pledging in our recent pledge drive. It helped a lot. Stay tuned for the 8 o'clock buzz and the BBC News before that here at WORTFM 89.9.
You're listening to WRT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Hello, I'm David Harper with the BBC News. Hamas has said it is ready to release the last living Israeli-American hostage it's known to be holding and hand over the remains of four other dual nationals captured during the 7th of October attacks. It made the announcement as indirect talks with Israel continue in Qatar. Yolande Nell is in Jerusalem.
As an Israeli soldier, under the terms of the original Gaza ceasefire agreement, it was expected that Adan Alexander would have been among the last hostages to be released. However, in an official statement, Hamas now says it's agreed to return the 21-year-old, who's also a US citizen, along with four bodies. It doesn't give details or make clear what it demands in return, but it's thought likely that the deal involves Israel releasing Palestinian prisoners and extending the fragile Gaza truce. Hamas said it's received a new ceasefire proposal from Qatari and Egyptian mediators and is responding with responsibility and a positive approach.
Russia and Ukraine have traded drone strikes overnight following talks about a ceasefire between President Trump's envoy and President Putin. The US negotiator Steve Witkoff has left Moscow after receiving what the Kremlin called new information. On Thursday, Mr. Putin said many issues about the ceasefire implementation should be analysed painstakingly by both sides. Danny Eberhard has more detail.
President Putin has raised many questions about the US ceasefire proposal. The Kremlin anticipates a phone call between him and Donald Trump soon. Both Moscow and Washington are talking of optimism, even if acknowledging lots of work ahead. It's certainly not shared by Kyiv. President Zelensky believes Vladimir Putin is manipulating a situation, raising preconditions to see the US proposal fail or be entangled in the long grass, while not outright rejecting it. Many seasoned Kremlin watchers see it likewise.
EU member states have agreed to extend their sanctions against more than 2,400 Russian individuals and entities for another 6 months. The decision needed to be unanimous, and Hungary's pro-Russian government had been threatening to veto the extension unless several people were removed from the list. The UN World Food Programme says it will cut off 1 million people in Myanmar from life-saving food assistance because of a shortfall in funding. The agency said it urgently needed $60 million in emergency funding. Celia Hatton has this report.
The World Food Programme did not say if the shortfall was due to cuts in aid spending by the Trump administration, but it was clear about the impact of that loss in funding. Unless it receives $60 million in emergency support from Myanmar, the WFP said it would have to withdraw from some parts of the war-torn country. 100,000 Rohingya people living in camps in Rakhine State, who are completely dependent on WFP assistance, would be among those impacted.
This is the latest world news from the BBC.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and TNW Ensemble Theatre, presenting Scammed, a new comedy running March 13th through March 23rd at TNW Ensemble Theatre, 1957 Winnebago Street. When a freelancing editor falls for a classic scam, she assumes the amoral alter ego of Helen Wheels to get even. Tickets are available at the door with cash or check or online through Ticket Tailor. More information is available by calling 608-770-0826.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Bluestem Jazz, presenting Twin Talk at the North Street Cabaret on Friday, March 21st at 8 p.m. Chicago's Twin Talk, featuring saxophonist Dustin Lorenzi, bassist singer Katie Ernst, and drummer Andrew Green, create a style that is elastic, spontaneous, and open. More information and tickets are available at bluestemjazz.org.
Thank you. It's the Friday 8 o'clock buzz. It's March 14. It's 8:05. I'm Andy Moore. So I had my third colonoscopy this week. Not the third colonoscopy this week. The third colonoscopy in my life. Jim Wilson, since we're not asking any personal questions this hour, have you ever had a colonoscopy?
I have not.
You haven't?
Not yet, no.
I'm sorry to hear that, but it's going to get in your pathway sooner or later. Since you haven't, and since our audience has never heard of my colonoscopies, I think we're going to have to, we need a soundtrack to my colonoscopy monologue. I think Tequila Sunrise, that'll be perfect. Can you find that? Folks, you'll see why in a minute, why that's a good tune. Jim, could you rack up Tequila Sunrise and play that now into my colonoscopy story?
Another tequila sunrise.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's no end. Maybe just a little more tequila sunrise. There's no end. Get it? End of jokes that come with a colonoscopy. When you tell people you're scheduled to have one, they all become Netflix-level comedians. I hope everything comes out okay, says one guy. I bet you can't wait to go, says another, and on and on. Of course, this is in reference to the preparation for a colonoscopy, otherwise known as the prep. This is the part that gets all the attention, as it should. Because let me tell you, after you drink that gallon and a half, and I'm not kidding about the quantity, you feel the mountain move. A little quake at first, and then it's like you're sitting on the San Andreas Fault. Sitting there on the toilet on Tuesday night, I thought my shoes were going to come out. But let's have breakfast, shall we? I mentioned this was my third colonoscopy. The procedure gives new meaning to lived experience. The first one I got goes back maybe 20 years ago. I had to start colonoscopies at a young age because my mother had polyps in her colon. Are we having breakfast yet? And that first prep that I took, well, you know, I was a rookie. And I took some liberties with it. I think it's fair to say Peggy and our kids were on a camp out. I couldn't go because of the colonoscopy. And I was bored the day I had to drink the gallon of prep juice. And I was also practicing banjo for a show. And it was a beautiful, warm summer afternoon. So I put the prepared prep go juice in a blender with some tequila. A fair amount of tequila. If you look up the quantity of tequila required for a colonoscopy prep drink, you can't find it. It turns out that you have to wing it, which I was surprised about. But I think I had it perfect. The problem was, Jim, I drank the dang stuff in like 40 minutes. I'm not exaggerating. Yet you're supposed, just as for your information, Jim, because it's coming to you sooner or later, you're supposed to take 3 hours to friggin' drink it. And that's without tequila. So at about minute 44, my stomach knotted up into it was like the size of a tennis ball. And I thought I was in labor, and I don't use those, you know, the word labor lightly. This was all before cell phones too, or at least before we had one. This is an important detail because I had to go across the house to get to the wall phone, emphasis on wall phone. The emphasis on wall is because after I made the journey, you just try to picture this. I was army crawling, like I was dodging bullets overhead through the house. I had to figure out how I was going to stretch my body out to reach the phone in the middle of the labor and delivery. Remember, there was also tequila involved. I got the phone in my hand and dialed the emergency number printed on the sticker on the giant jug of prep juice. And, you know, folks, I'm sorry. Many of you have probably had colonoscopies, and this story is, I'm sure, just like your own. And I'm sorry to bore you with it, but I'll try to finish as quick as I can. Okay, so I get the emergency colonoscopy prep lady on the phone, and I tell her what my situation is. I leave out the tequila part because what I flavor the solution with is a matter of taste, right? None of her business. And so she says right away, how much time did you take drinking the solution? And I told her 45 minutes. And then I hear her announce in a side voice to her fellow emergency colonoscopy phone call helpers. They are in the emergency phone call helper central. He drank it in 45 minutes. And I swear to God, I could overhear them laughing and high-fiving in the lap. So that was the first colonoscopy. I'm not going to drag you through the second, but I'm much older now. I'm wiser, more mature. For example, this week I used gin instead of tequila. Kidding. No, this week I just used the lemon packet that came glued to the big jug. I used the word lemon flavored lightly. On Wednesday, it all went down, and the team at UW Gastro Health, I'm telling you, they're a crack team. It could not have been better. It all worked out in the end. See what I did there? The drugs they give you, by the way, give new meaning to Tequila Sunrise. Let me tell you, even just the expectation of the dreamy potion got me worked up. The nurse plugged me in the vein, and then she left and came back 10 minutes later. And I announced to her, I'm really getting dreamy here. And I had a big grin on my face. And she said, that's just saline solution, Andy. And I said, of course, I knew that. I didn't know that. But when they stabbed me with the real thing, Jim, I asked the anesthesiologist, I swear, I asked her, how long will it take to get to the dreamy part? And she said, about now. And let me be clear. These people know what they're doing. This isn't a commercial for colonoscopies. You know, it's just good, you know, personal health. But after I woke up and had some peanut butter crackers, and that nurse brought them into me, well, let me just tell you, I wrote a hit song. My pal David picked me up out front, even though the crackers were just a few minutes before that. It was kind of a foggy memory. But at last, David brought me a bag of potato chips and a peanut butter cookie thing. And if that story, dear listeners, doesn't make you hungry for breakfast, I don't think you're all the way awake yet. Thank you, Jim, for the playback. That's the Tequila Sunrise colonoscopy rant for March 14th. I'll tell you about the second colonoscopy this time next week. Stay tuned. Okay, we got a prep for a great hour ahead at about 8:45. Magic. That's right, an in-demand medicine magician with a unique show that's scheduled for next month will be here to perform magic right before your ears. Poetry this morning, too, at 8:30, former Wisconsin poet Dee Sweet will join us live from Bayfield on the shores of Lake Superior to talk about her new children's book and share a poem. And in just a minute, we'll hear all about the healthy movement known as Roots Farm to School Music by Friday Buzz DJ Spin Cycle, a.k.a. Ankur Malhotra. Ankur will also give you guidance making your weekend live music choices and Ankur's picks. Jim Wilson, Engineer Without Peer, is here. Good morning to Elliot LeBrun running the front desk. He's our online producer. It's magic. It's poetry. It's healthy food. Where on else? Well, could this possibly happen? It's the Friday 8 o'clock buzz. That's where on else. Let's get buzzing. It's the Friday 8 o'clock buzz. I'm Andy Moore, segment one. In addition to sanity, there are a lot of other things on hold in the Trump administration. You know, little things like continuing 100-year-long relations with our allies, and not selling cars on the White House front lawn to profit a guy who has more money than most of our allied countries do. And then there's money frozen or eliminated for programs that help, you know, Americans just trying to get by or to have healthy lives. As of March 2025, the USDA federal grants that help fund the program known as Farm to School are on hold. This is serious business, folks. The financial burden now falls on schools as though they're loaded to make up the shortfall, ranging from an increase of 20 to 100% based on the school's economic disadvantage rates. Without this additional funding support, schools may opt, many will opt, to cut their school garden programs. What are the stakes here? Our first guest this morning believes every school that wants a garden should have one. They work with the organization called Rooted, which provides garden education to schools. Good morning to Rooted Farm to School Director Erica Krug and to Dan Walkner.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Hi, Andy. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for joining us on The Buzz. Erica, put the product of a garden on hold for a second. Mm-hmm. What happens when a child experiences a garden?
So one of my favorite quotes comes from Ron Finley. He's an urban gardener in California. And he says, when kids grow kale, kids eat kale.
I like that.
Yeah, I like that a lot. So, and I've seen this happen at the Troy Kids Garden, one of our youth farm sites on the north side. I have seen kindergartners just walk past a row of kale, rip off a stem, and just like munch into it. We also have raspberries growing there. Kids go and pick them and pop them in their mouths and just declare, like, this is the greatest day of my life. So, you know, gardens have a lot of magic in them, like watching a seed get planted and then turn into something that you can eat. It's hands-on, dig-in-the-dirt education. It motivates kids to try fruits and vegetables, to love fruits and vegetables. It's a lot of kids who don't feel successful in traditional classrooms also find success in the garden because it's a completely different tactile experience. So they're great for like a number of reasons, not to mention also mental health.
Right. Well, let's keep digging, if I could use that word. Talk more about, it's a wonderful picture to make that physical connection, but the image of a child holding a stalk of kale in their hand and munching it, standing right there where they help grow it.
Yeah.
But take us more deeply into what that connection means, what it means to them beyond that moment.
Well, so, you know, I have memories of being in the garden with my mom as a kid, and my grandpa grew corn in Iowa, and then we would pop it in the summer and have it at night. So I think, you know, to understand where your food comes from, not to just go to a grocery store and see food on the shelf and not understand that it grows in the ground or on a tree, is really important. We need to know where our food comes from. We also need to know, you know, if you're the person growing it, or also know the local farmers in our area that are growing that food, so you can also make that connection. But I think it grounds us in, you know, who we are, where we live in Wisconsin. We have an amazing agriculture system, and I think it's so important for us to learn as early as we can that, like, you know, eating foods grown here in the earth is really important for our health. You know, it creates more resilient food systems if we're relying on our local agriculture as opposed to having things shipped here from California in trucks.
Right, right. It certainly takes the mystery out of it. You mentioned your own family experience. My father grew the best homegrown tomatoes in the state of Kentucky.
Oh yeah.
And he was so proud of it.
Uh-huh.
And so we're seeing modeling happen too.
Right.
I saw the energy and the pride that he took with those, and he'd march them up and down the street and give them away, and they were delicious.
Oh yeah.
It's important, and it's worthy for children to see everything that grown-ups do, but to make and to normalize and to make the nature connection to what's on your plate. Speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, well, I mean, I used to teach at Lakeview Elementary School. It's where we have one of our current school garden sites, and a lot of our students there were English language learners. And I remember one of my students, Shua, one time we were out in the garden, we were getting ready to plant, and he, you know, he took the seedling, and he started to show us, you know, how you should sort of like start to get the roots kind of spread out before you put them in the ground. This was a third grade student, and he had learned that from his family growing. They had the garden plot at Troy Farm right by Lakeview. So he was suddenly like teaching us how to do something. So for him to have that, you know, opportunity to show off his knowledge and his experiences with garden and sharing it was just like this kind of moment where I realized, you know, like this is where it's at.
Growing community together is Rooted slogan, or motto.
Yeah.
It's an organization. Some people may be hearing about for the very first time this morning. Yeah. So I kind of got ahead of ourselves with some of the other connections. Sure. But give us a thumbnail just about what the organization muscles together.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, we're committed to collaborations in food, land, and learning. So you're right. Rooted, not everybody necessarily knows the name Rooted, but a lot of people in our community, I think, are familiar with us maybe through some entity. So if you've heard of Troy Farm is part of Rooted. So Troy Farm is an urban farm on the north side. We are bringing back our CSA and pizza nights this summer. There's also community garden plots there. We have a kids garden site there. So kids come there in the summer from neighborhood centers. We also do field trips. Rooted is our farm to school programming that you mentioned. So we have we currently are working with an AmeriCorps farm to school program. We also have a gardener in residence program. We help maintain and provide garden educators at about 10 schools right now in Madison for garden-based education.
That's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but
no,
I didn't realize there were that many schools enrolled.
There are. Yeah.
And wow, it really puts more heaviness on funding.
Definitely. It does. And a lot of the schools that we work with are some of the highest economically disadvantaged schools in the city, which is kind of this sense of urgency of
let's go there at fundraising and so forth. But listeners, if you're just joining us, I'm talking about school gardens with Rooted Farm to School Director Erica Krug. Dan Walkner is also here. Rooted has a big fundraiser coming up on May 24, and that's when Farm to School Aid will happen at Troy Farm in Madison. Hey, Dan, what will happen on the 24th?
Well, we're going to have a little party over at Troy Garden, Troy Farm. And there's going to be music, there's going to be food, there's going to be beverages, there may be secret desserts. We got Mango Man's going to be down there with a food cart.
M&J
Jamaican Kitchen.
Lola's.
Nice. So far, and we're kind of working on this as we go. The music, Chris Plata and Plata.
Oh.
One of our favorite bands and just Madison legends.
And Chris has an agricultural background.
Yes, he does.
Very interesting.
Absolutely.
Yes.
I've been wanting to, this idea has been like kind of percolating for a while, mainly because, I mean, I love their band so much and, you know, the butterfly song. So several years ago, I was like, Chris, if we ever do a concert fundraiser for, you know, a school garden, would you do it? And he was like, yes.
Perfect. So Chris and
so
who
Chris
else?
Plata, Free Dirt, Good Rockin'. Love those guys. And plus, I mean, Free Dirt. And we got my group's going to be down there playing. And then
you have a special guest performing with you, though, too.
Teresa Marie from People Brothers is going to play. We'll probably try to sneak a couple other special people involved, get them involved. And then Tani Jacate is going to be playing with his crew. And basically, we kind of wanted to have a nice mix of bands, but we also wanted to...
And Tani plays Afro funk, for people who don't know. It's energizing.
It's literally an electric gourd, and I've played with him a few times, and it's a pretty magical experience.
There's a fancier name for it, but I mean it's a beautiful, seems to me impossible to play. Instrument.
It's one of those ones where you look at it and you're like, I don't really know what's going on, but it's pretty awesome. So we kind of wanted to get people that we knew that were in kind of on the scene and involved in progressive causes, and also a bunch of the people in the bands have kids in MMSD that are going to these schools that are served by the gardens. Our kid goes to Shank. We know there's another member from Free Dirt that has a kid that goes to Shank. There's a couple kids at Crestwood.
Yes.
Our school has a school garden. The school I work with at Memorial, we have a school garden.
You know, it's an opportunity for you guys. Having you on is so nice because this topic is interesting, and as you're just revealing, Dan, they're probably parents of Madison school kids who have children in these schools who may not know that this program exists. It not that it's not well known, but
people are busy. So right. It might be worth asking your kid, what's up? You got a garden at school or what's going on?
That's exactly right.
Part of it too is that that's what, you know, the financing helps with is like teachers are very busy and have a lot to do. And you can't, if you pile things on, then that's going to take the fun out of it. But if you have a dedicated person coming mm-hmm. once a week or a couple times a week to your school and being like, let's go outside, everybody. And that brings a lot of joy to it. Gets the kids out of the building. And not only that, but it gives the teachers a little time away. And then at the end of it, they get to, you know, munch on some delicious fruits and vegetables.
Speaking of which, on the 24th, it occurs to me that people will be in kind of full mode at Troy as well. Will mm-hmm. there be like demonstration? I picture people actually doing gardening while all this is taking place.
They definitely could be. There are, I don't have the exact number, but there are a lot of community garden plots right in the area where we'll be. And yeah, for sure. By then, there will be folks out there probably working while the music's playing, and you can walk around. And it's so fun to see how everybody, what they're growing, and the different ways that people kind of set up their yes. their plots. So yeah, it'll be in full bloom. We're also going to have kids' activities. So we do have a kids' garden right there on site. So there's going to be members of the
Bell Phillips Sewing and Crafting Club will be down there helping out with the kids.
Yeah. Oh, and man. We also have some garden educators who are also going to be helping lead some kids' activities.
And all that music. But finally, in just a minute or so mm-hmm. that we have left, Erica, this question. What do children miss out on who never experience what it's like to grow a garden?
Wow. That is, yeah. To try to answer that like in a minute, I think would be hard. But, you know, the thing about gardens is that it really brings learning to life. I think, you know, I used to teach elementary school, and I know that science was like one of those subjects that we just really weren't given a ton of time to teach during the day. And now with everything that's happening with like climate change and global warming, you know, I think, and I mean, science is just so fun. I would have kids that didn't really necessarily want to always be in the classroom. And anytime we would bring out the science kits, because that was the only time that we did anything hands-on, immediately they would want to be there and they would be engaged. And so never getting to have a garden means like you don't understand that this is an important, first of all, skill to learn how to grow your own food. And you also don't have, you're missing out on kind of that hands-on, dig in the dirt education where things just really come to life, where you can see a seed turn into something that you can eat. You can incorporate so many different lessons into yes. the garden. There yes. are so many opportunities for kids to interact with one another and for teamwork. So, and there's, you know, not to mention like all of the natural physical activities that come with it, like seeing kids pushing wheelbarrows full of mulch, you know, carrying things together, having to figure out how to water something from a water source that's far away and doing it as a team. Mm. There's just like, it's just, it brings, you know, it brings everything really to life.
Erica, there's nothing like the experience of hearing an elementary school teacher describe what it's like when they see the lights come on. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for that, Erica. And Mr. Dan Walkner, thanks for joining us on the Friday Buzz. You all, and have a great weekend.
Thanks,
thank you,
this
Andy.
Was so
great
fun. Thanks,
here.
Andy.
You're so welcome. Erica Krug and Dan Walkner. Rooted has a big fundraiser, and that's what we've been talking about, coming up on May 24. I asked Erica to check in on the phone the week prior to that so that she can remind us of all that good stuff, and so we'll be hearing from her in another month or two. So May 24, that's when Farm to School Aid will happen at Troy Farm in Madison. Okay, from gardening with children to a new children's book. Our next guest is former state poet laureate Dee Sweet, whose new children's book is being published later this month. But first, music, some boring announcements, and encore picks for live music for the coming weekend. This is the Friday Buzz on WRT-FM 89.9 in Madison, Wisconsin. It's 8:29.
Could ever soak in all the places you anoint. Support for this program comes from WORT's listener sponsors and Isthmus Newspaper. Isthmus is back on newsstands the first Thursday of every month, and now a nonprofit. Isthmus continues to expand its independent coverage of local government, the arts, and all things Madison at isthmus.com.
WORT would like to thank the following local restaurants and businesses who provided meals for our hardworking volunteers during our recent fall pledge drive. Bandung, Bonzo, Cardinal Bar, Cooper's Tavern, Einstein's Coffee and Bagels, Epic Mortgage Lending, Festival Foods, Glass Nickel Pizza West, Hong Kong Cafe, Ian's Pizza, Just Veggies, Lao Lang Zan, Mickey's Tavern, Melio's on MLK, Original Pancake House on University Avenue, Pizza Bruta, Soups I Did It Again in Spring Green, Teddy Wedgers, Weary Traveler, Wilma's Fund LGBT Assistance, and the Willie Street Co-op. WORT would like to extend our gratitude to these restaurants for helping put the community in WORT Community Radio through their donations of food. Gratefully yours for nearly five decades, this is WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Friday 8 o'clock buzz. I'm Andy Moore. It being the Friday 8 o'clock buzz, the weekend is ahead of us. You have yet to make your choices for live music experiences this weekend. You're in luck. That's because Encore Malhotra is here with Encore's Picks. But first, here's Jim Wilson with the Encore's Picks disclaimer.
Encore's Picks are not influenced by any outside entities. Encore consults with an advisory board of one, Encore Malhotra. The cost of admission to any recommended show is of no concern to Encore, nor the price of beer, nor the cleanliness of the venue restrooms. Encore has one goal and one goal only in the delivery of Encore's Picks, for you to have a kick-ass musical experience. Encore's Picks is a trademark of the multinational corporation DJ Spin Cycle. All copy and trade therein is solely possessed. Here's Encore Malhotra!
Good morning, Madison and the whole wide world. Yeah, speaking of restrooms, bathrooms, there's some pretty swanky, cool ones I've been passing through in Canada and Europe recently. Maybe there needs to be some social media sharings of bathroom stalls. Maybe not. But yeah, lots of music coming up this weekend. It's St. Patrick's Day happening. And of course, there's the Kissers who are going to be playing two shows at the High Noon Saloon. One's kid-friendly afternoon show and another one later. And that's March 15th. That's tomorrow. But let's jump into today. Today, People Brothers Band at the Burr Oak. And then tomorrow, we got Steely Dan at Stoughton Opera House. And get your dancing shoes on for Jams with Ja, Zip Disc, B2B with DJ TH at the Gamma Ray. That's it for this weekend, folks. Enjoy spring.
All right, Encore, thank you. We're going to play just a little bit more of this music bed while Jim gets our next guest on. That's Denise Sweet, who will join us from Bayfield. We'll be right back with a conversation with Anishinaabe poet D. Sweet.
Here or there?
I would not like them here or there. I would not like them anywhere. I do not like green eggs and ham. I do not like them, Sam I am.
Would you like them in a house? Would you like them with a mouse?
I do not like them in a house. I do not like them with a mouse. I do not like them here or there. I do not like them anywhere. I do not like green eggs and ham. I do not like them, Sam, I am.
Okay.
Ankur, you got the magic touch, man. We will now sail into our conversation about children's literature with our next guest. I'm Andy Moore. It's the Friday 8 o'clock buzz. Anishinaabe poet Denise Sweet is a former state poet laureate. She's a member of the White Earth Ojibwe. She's also a storyteller, a teacher, a UW Green Bay professor emerita, and now, or at least later this month, a published children's author. That's when her new book, Do Rabbits Have Habits, will be released. March is National Reading Month, so it's the perfect time to explore a new book with your family. Dee joins us now on the phone from her home near Bayfield. Good morning, Dee, and welcome back to the Friday Buzz.
Well, good morning to all, and I'm happy to be here with you this morning.
From the North. The title, Do Rabbits Have Habits? What's that all about?
Well, back when my sons were both younger, quite a bit younger, toddlers and a little bit older than that, they were endlessly asking me for questions that were, you know, how come bumblebees can fly? Why do cats purr? And half the time, these questions are posed to me in the middle of, you know, some other activity. And oftentimes I'd have to say, you know, I don't know. And so that's where it generally comes. Yeah.
That curiosity, a child asking a question is, I see it certainly as an opportunity for the child to learn. But what can a grown-up get out of answering a child's question?
Well, it pushes us to be imaginative, to be entertaining, to come up with an answer that is probably, you know, just satisfactory for the moment. Mm. But for me as a mother, it helped me enter into my journal certain moments that I wanted to remember. And part of it was these endless questions. And I started writing poems for my kids. And they really did enjoy that sort of rocking horse rhythm that we find in poetry.
Mm. Why do you think we stop asking so many questions when we grow up?
Well, because when we're grown-ups, we know everything. So we don't need to pose any questions because we know all the answers. And that certainly wasn't true for me. But I think that that's one of the reasons why we stop being inquisitive, because we figure we already know the answers to the questions that may enter into our minds. I think maybe that might have something to do with it.
You know, you mentioned the bumblebee questions and had some of those examples that most of we parents can make a connection to. A child's question can sometimes be so simple as to be nearly unanswerable, can't it?
That's true. It's true. If I were to explain why a bumblebee can fly, you know, there is no common sense to it at all, no logic, because, you know, a bumblebee operates on the notion of lift, like a helicopter. But, suffice it to say, nobody told the bumblebee that they couldn't fly. So here's the dilemma.
I like the way you connected it a moment ago, these unanswerable questions, to pushing the grown-up to use their imagination.
Yes. Exactly, which is a lot of fun. We don't get that opportunity very often.
No, there's plenty of time in life, like decades, to be literal, isn't there?
Absolutely.
Now, tell us how.
And then there are times.
I'm sorry?
Pardon me. You know, I just wanted to say, but then there are times where it's legitimate to say, you know, I don't know. Let's find out.
Especially in these times when everything is catered out so black and white, and no one can just put. You just press pause and say, I don't know. Maybe we can find out together, you know?
Yes.
How does the narrative work, and do rabbits have habits?
Well, what happens is that they're all questions. They're written in couplets. And so the questions are, for example, on the first page, do turtles jump hurdles and have grandma myrtles? And so there is that you know, it's the form is in couplets, and they're endless questions over and over again.
I've seen a few pages, and the artwork is spectacular. Tell us about that.
Well, the artwork is very clever, very beautiful, and I am so thrilled to be working with the artist. And I think that if we look closely at the illustrations, there are little stories in those illustrations, things that we might overlook in the, you know, as we breeze through the books. But it's so much fun, and I think that that's going to be really a plus for the young ones, because they're going to find those little puzzles, those little, you know, secret messages in the illustrations. We may overlook them in our zest to just sort of read through the book, but I want readers to take their time and look at the illustrations and how much they have to say in terms of social comment.
Oh, lovely. The art brings a story within a story in that way.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But you didn't tell us who the illustrator is, I don't think.
Well, you know, I've got to make sure that I, Aaron Kant Barnard. Now, I've been referring to her as Kant, you know, but I know that she had, you know, several, you know, sort of a hyphenated name, and I wanted to make sure I got that.
But, Dee, how can readers find the book?
Well, the book will be launched towards the end of March, and they can locate the book by Googling Black Bears and Blueberry Press, a press that is tribally owned by a novelist by the name of Tom Peacock. So if they want further information, I'm happy to send you an email so you have direct information on how to locate the book.
Very good.
Several readings, too, so that'll be one way.
Oh, lovely. I want to tell the listeners that you're responsible for me learning a few things since I started doing this show. one of them was my discovery of how much I love to hear poetry on the radio. In your past visits, you've been generous enough to read one of your poems, and I've asked you to share one this morning before we let you go. Would you set that up and read it now?
I sure will. One of the gifts of Do Rabbits Have Habits is exposure to our Ojibwe language. And so there's a glossary in the book that gives you the words in Ojibwe for rabbits, or, you know, for grandmother, or for pillow, or for turtle. So there's a sort of a linguistic lesson that comes in this book as well. And I'd like to read Do Rabbits Have Habits for you this morning.
Oh, lovely.
Okay. So, do rabbits have habits? Do turtles jump hurdles and have grandma myrtles? And do they need pillows to dream armadillos? Do ducks do their dances with webby feet prances? And do they prefer polkas while sharing fudge mochas? Can giraffes keep from laughing while they are giraffing, yet remember their manners while eating bananas? Did a horse take a course on what's making him hoarse? And did he learn to speak Latin from sows dressed in satin? And where is the owl with his crabby pants scowl? And what about kitties who live in the cities? Are they really that shy, or can they be witty? I especially like foxes who like wearing socks and keep their fur coats all packed up in boxes. And do you know about parrots who only eat carrots? They chirp and they burp and they love teasing ferrets. And those fuzzy-haired poodles who slurp their egg noodles, and instead of their homework, they daydream and doodle. And what about lions who can't stop from crying? And those wily coyotes who can't keep from lying? And in case you're not certain of just what is so, I'll go ask my mom, who I'm sure doesn't know.
Oh, Dee Sweet, thank you for joining us on the Friday Buzz. Congratulations on the new book, and I so look forward to you returning for another visit.
Absolutely. You have a great day.
Okay. Thank you, Dee. Dee Sweet is an Anishinaabe poet and author. Her new children's book, which we just heard, is called Do Rabbits Have Habits? All right. From children's books to
magic. Up next, I'll introduce you to an in-demand Madison magician who has a big, or I should say small, show coming up next month. We'll explain. You're listening to WRTFM in Madison, Wisconsin. It's 8:45. Friday O'Clock Buzz, I'm Andy Moore. Okay, I got a confession. We've always believed that this is a magical show. And by we, I mean, of course, Jim Wilson, Ankur Malhotra, Elliot LeBrun, our Friday Buzz team. But we really couldn't say it was magical with a straight face until this morning. And that's because I'm joined now by magician Matthew Teague. He's performed magic around the world to audiences large and small. Next month, he puts the emphasis on small with the show in Verona, which we'll hear about. It's called What If, and it happens on April 5th at the Lynx at Pioneer Point in Verona. Matthew Teague joins us now. Good morning and welcome to the Friday Buzz.
Good morning. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to meet you. We'll get to What If, as I said, in a minute. But first, why do you think magic is so appealing to people of all ages?
To me, magic is like that moment when you imagine anything can happen. It's like about hopes, dreams, and visions. And I really believe that magic can be therapeutic, almost like how music is therapeutic, you know, for treating all kinds of things. But with magic, I think it can spark somebody's imagination into making things possible that weren't before.
I'm seizing on your really choice of imagination. And yeah. The audience just heard a lovely segment from Dee Sweet, a children's author, who talked about children's questions demand in a way that grown-ups keep their imagination intact. And it sounds like you're saying magic does that too.
I think that's beautiful. Yeah, I think magic is all about the imagination because it's all basically taking something from your mind and trying to bring it into reality.
Uh-huh. Expanding the corridors of your belief system. What attracted you to magic, Matthew?
I think it was that, just the breakthrough of like limiting beliefs that I had at the time as far as what was possible for myself and for life and for for everything. When I was 12 years old, I had a real kind of breakthrough where I met a magician in Albuquerque, New Mexico named Paul Cockrell, and he had done a coin trick for me, and you know, there was no place to hide. It was all happening in my hands, and it just seemed completely impossible. And so once I realized that there was magic that existed like that wasn't just like from far away, but could feel so personal, I really like fell through the rabbit hole completely and fell in love with the art and was in the library like every day trying to find, you know.
You feel hard.
Yeah, the history.
I want to talk about proximity in a moment, but what was the first trick you learned?
Probably, how to make a coin vanish. Yeah, my grandpa used to do magic tricks and dabble a little bit. And, you know, it was like that or blowing up your muscle, but I don't know if that counts. You know what I mean?
What?
You know, he used to like pretend to blow his muscles up.
Through his thumb.
You know how grandpas okay. are, goofballs, you know? But yeah, my grandpa was really a charismatic, uh-huh. and, just sincere, funny, interesting person. So wow. he was always kind of doing stuff at the dinner table. And one of them was a coin vanish that he showed me. And that I carried with me for the longest time. And I always knew that magic could get a real reaction because of it.
But magicians choose several pathways, I suppose, when they begin, including prop magic, etc. From what I've read, you take pride in the closeness and simplicity of your approach to the art. Tell us about that.
Well, I like all magic, but to me, there's something really special about just having something happen for you specifically in like a magic effect. I think that, like I said, I think it's easier to have that kind of breakthrough if you have a solid connection with somebody. And I think it's harder to really connect in a personal way from afar on stage. When you meet somebody and then you like bring them through that journey, it's just a completely different feeling. It's so hard to describe why that is. It's almost like every, there's little touches that change the way that the audience sees things. Like when I used to do restaurant magic, I would walk around and go table to table. And I had a mentor in magic named Eugene Berger, based out of Chicago, world famous magician. But he used to suggest to me to sit down at the tables. And to me, that seemed outrageous because I'm like, they're paying me all this money. I can't sit down. Like, I'm going to look like I'm not working, you know? But he stressed the fact that when you sit down with the table, you become one of them. And then you become one of the group performing for the group versus somebody that walked up and is performing at the group.
Wow. Actually, if I'm listening correctly, that amplifies the effect and the magic if you become a peer.
Absolutely.
Who's making something special happen.
Absolutely.
Now, there's an application to this approach. In your choice to do a small audience, you can do larger audiences as you wish, but this is going to be a very exclusive experience, for want of a better word, in your Verona show. Talk about that. You purposely have chosen, I think it's a ceiling of 50 audience members.
You got it. Yeah, the goal is to keep them close and to try to have that feeling of like, I guess, lack of better phrase, like sitting at the table with them. There's not going to be a table, but there's basically like a you know, semi-round circle, and everybody is going to be really up close and able to see everything from, you know, like, you know, less than 12 feet away, of course.
Yes, yeah. A real community experience. Now, there's got to be a, you know, some foibles and downside to this up close stuff. When you're doing up close magic like that and you screw up, not that ever happens, but you're human, what are some of the ways a magician hides an error?
Oh, there's a ton. The thing about close up magic is it's a lot harder to hide things. You know, I mean, you don't have lights and stage, and you know, you really have to, you know, you have to really work on stuff so that it does, so the mistakes don't happen.
But when they do,
usually it's like a jazz musician, you know, like I've gotten good at learning how to like pivot and go in a different direction and make it seem like that was part of the trick in the first place. Like a jazz musician, when they mess up, it's like, you know, they mess up and then they do it again. They're like, well, maybe that was on purpose. Oh, and then all of a sudden it sounds like, cool. Well, maybe that was part of the song.
Yeah.
It's sort of like that in magic where you know, if you get to a point where you know your material really, really well, you can pivot. So like if a trick goes off, you can go in a different direction and people kind of wonder, was that how it was meant to be? And sometimes they have no idea that it actually did mess up because of that, because you go into a different direction.
This brings some terminology to my mind, and I don't want it to be confused with what you just said, but magicians, you hear them use the word misdirect. What does that mean?
Misdirect is actually almost, it's almost a phrase that's misused, because misdirection kind of makes you think that the whole idea is that I'm going to make you look over here and make it impossible for you to look over there, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Whereas usually it's just a direction of attention. Like, it's really directing attention.
Oh.
And you know, that's part of the reason why magic works, is because one of the principles is that when like two objects are moving at the exact same time and they end the movement at the exact same time, one of those movements becomes invisible. So we kind of exploit that sometimes.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Okay, that's many of our audience who love magic know the show, the Penn and Teller Fool Us show. Real quickly, because I want to get you said you would help us with a trick or show us a trick this
morning. Yeah, hopefully I don't mess up.
But before we do the trick, yeah, we're close. But I want to just quickly, what was it like to perform for Penn and Teller?
Oh, that was amazing. It was so surreal. It was like a dream, basically. As a kid, you know, I've been watching them since I was really young. They've been around for a long time. And I've, you know, of course, like most magicians, imagined being on a show like that. So when you actually do it, you wake up the next day, you're like, was that a dream? You know, like that really happened, didn't it? And then, you know, months later,
Were you mostly calm during it, or were you pretty nervous?
I think I was in a rare space of mind, because I had just gone through some things, like when my mother had passed away a few months prior, and then my great aunt Reme had passed away in Gary, Indiana, and I came from that funeral like 2 days before. Mm-hmm. And so I think I was just like in this space of like just acceptance and appreciation and gratitude, and it just put me in a different place.
All of those things were reminders that there are bigger things even than magic. So.
Exactly, it put me in my space.
Well, there's no bigger thing than magic than the trick right now, folks. Have you ever done a trick on the radio?
Never, no.
Oh, good. Okay, I'm gonna hand it over. I'll be in your hands, so to speak, here at the table, and here's Matthew Teague just go ahead and take it away.
Okay, gotcha. You know, I might kind of do this somewhat impromptu. I noticed you have your cell phone on the table.
Yes.
Do you mind going into your cell phone and finding your calculator? And then everybody at home.
The calculator?
Yeah, the calculator, okay. Yeah. And everybody at home, you can go into your cell phone and find the calculator as well, as long as you're not driving or anything.
Good.
And then go and open up your calculator.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to show everybody how nothing is actually random. Could you give me like a four-digit number, Andy?
A what?
A four-digit number.
2042.
2042. Let's put 2042 into the calculator.
Okay.
2042.
Uh-huh.
And then hit plus.
Okay.
Great. And then we've got some numbers up here. Would you pick out, should we do the first three or the last three of those numbers?
Okay. 752.
Okay, great. Put 752 into your phone. And everybody else at home, put 752 into your phone.
Those are the last three digits on the digital clock here for folks. Yes, go ahead.
752 and hit plus.
Yes.
Great. And then give me just a random four-digit number that might be significant to you.
32.
32?
Yes.
Great. And then give me one more two-digit number.
You want me to enter 32?
Not yet.
Okay. 17.
Gotcha. So let's put 3217.
Okay.
So we're going to hit 3217. We're going to add those in. 32.
Plus?
Yep. 17.
Okay.
And then we're going to speed this up a little bit because we're kind of running out of time. Would you hold out your finger like this for me, Andy?
Yeah.
And then we're going to hit just a bunch of numbers here. I just want to make sure you don't click.
I'm punching his cell phone now, just randomly.
Okay, gotcha.
I can't even see what I'm punching.
Yeah, okay, good. So make sure we don't clear
anything out. Yeah, a bunch of numbers.
Yeah, we got a bunch of numbers. Yeah. Would you put all these numbers in, and everybody at home too? We're going to add in now 3134848.
Those numbers came from Matthew just holding his phone upside down and me punching them. Okay.
Yep. And then hit equals.
And hit what?
Equals.
Okay.
And everybody at home hit equals. Yeah.
Yeah.
So here's the wild thing. Could you write down? You got a pen and piece of paper here. Would you write this down?
This
number? We've got one digit at a time. It's 3140859.
Yes.
So this is how nothing is random. This is what's so wild is this a moment in time. Like today's date is what is today's date?
March 14th,
right? And if everybody looked at your phones right now.
Oh my God. And it's 8:59.
It's the moment we're living in.
I can't even finish the show, folks. We only have 30 seconds. I'm yelling into the mic. That was something else. I'm not letting you out of here till you tell me how you did that, but I know you won't. Matthew Teague, that was the real thing, man. Thank you so much for joining us on the Friday Buzz. We got to wrap up in 10 seconds. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah.
Matthew's show, What Up, it happens on April 5th at the Link at Pioneer Point in Verona. That was insane. Okay, everybody, we got to wrap this up. We've got Chris Powers waiting and the Insurgent Radio Kiosk. You're listening to WRT FM 89.9 in Madison, Wisconsin. Have a great damn weekend. Aloha. Kamaaina.
Friday, March 14th.
Last week,
the Democratic Party's top congressional leaders finally took a bold stand against Trump's assault on our democracy when he came to Congress to tout his autocratic agenda. Traditionally, when a president arrives to address Congress, a bipartisan escort committee leads the dignitary to the podium. But by gollies, Democratic leaders Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries showed their toughness by, get this, refusing to have Democrats join the escort committee. Wow, imagine how that uplifted the millions of people being stomped on by Trump's rampage. Is this feeble response better than nothing? Believe it or not, doing nothing is another strategy proposed by former Bill Clinton operative James Carville. He says the smart thing for Democrats to do is to roll over and play dead. Carville actually declares that fighting Trump is futile, so just allow the Republicans to crumble beneath their own weight and make the American people miss us. Excuse me, but wasn't that the party's theory in 2016 and 2024? Let Trump rant and he'll defeat himself. Instead,